China is now an emerging global power that's reshaping global economic relations. U.S. officials in various administrations have been concerned with what they describe as the rise of China. Beijing is now flexing its muscle in areas where the U.S. had traditionally been counted as an unmatched rival. China has decided to get close to Persian Gulf Arab states in what appears to be a direct confrontational move against the U.S. Furthermore, China is dictating its own rules and emerging business ties there. Earlier in December 2022, China's President Xi Jinping met high-ranking Saudi officials and other Persian Gulf Arab leaders to boost business ties and oil relations between China and Arab states. What's more important is the fact that China and Saudi Arabia are planning to trade their oil in China's national currency, the yuan. The talks with China over yuan-priced oil contracts have been off and on for 6 years, but have accelerated this year. China buys more than 25% of the oil that Saudi Arabia exports. If priced in yuan, those sales would boost the standing of China's currency. The Saudis are also considering including yuan-denominated futures contracts, known as the petro-yuan, in the pricing model of Aramco.
Online social media posts on this topic were so much that we couldn't even keep up with the different reactions. Taking a look at the visit itself, which was not covered as much in the Western media, it was very evident that people took notice of the fact that the Chinese president was in Saudi Arabia with a reception from not just Saudi Arabia, but also countries of the Persian Gulf, showing the importance that China has placed on its currency, the yuan, and how it wants to internationalize it. Let's take a look at some of these posts in order to see what I'm saying. First up, Xi Jinping says in speech in Saudi Arabia that his country will make full use of the Shanghai Petroleum and National Gas Exchange to carry out yuan settlement of oil and gas trade. Next post, great achievement for a peaceful and diverse multilateral world. Next, dollar has ended. Alert. Next post, time for the U.S. to cut off Saudi defense purchases and open the Iranian oil taps. Then, our final post, is going to hit the fan, is going to be the end of the fake petrodollar and the rogue printing thereof of a currency that is absolutely useless, not linked to gold or silver, but linked to someone else's asset, Arab oil.
Petroleum. See, what's important here is that the Biden administration has drained the strategic oil reserves in the United States. And the only way to get it back is by purchasing cheap Russian oil. And then Putin says, sorry.
Okay, there you had it. Those were some of the posts that we picked. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of Economic Divide. Matthew Efrid, Senior Fellow at the American University in Moscow, joins us. He's also an editor-in-chief of the Canadian Patriot Review. And he's the author of Clash of the Two Americas. In addition, he's the founder of the Rising Tide Foundation. All right, quite a resume there. Matthew Efrid, welcome to Economic Divide. When we take a look at the visit by the Chinese President Xi Jinping, very well received, Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf Arab countries at the same time receiving China and its president. They want to buy oil and gas. Well, China has proposed that in the yuan, and that establishes Beijing's goal to internationalize the yuan and also weaken the U.S.'s grip on the dollar. Why would the Chinese president make such a request, payment in yuan, do you think?
China and Xi Jinping right now are very much committed to the development of the Belt and Road Initiative as their primary means of attaining not only friendships, but also global security and development. It is the biggest multidimensional infrastructure project in history, and their commitment right now is to create a viable new architecture, which is outside of the influence and control of the IMF, the World Bank, the Anglo-American establishment, which seeks only hegemony at this point. So right now, China needs a lot of petroleum, a lot of crude oil, natural gas. That is a desperate component of their orientation. At the Arab Peninsula supplies China. They're the world's largest oil importer. Half of that comes from the Arab Peninsula. A quarter of that comes from, as a whole, Saudi Arabia. And so China needs partners who actually care about their own survival and their own self-interest, which is not something that they've discovered they could find from, at the moment, the Anglo-American establishment, which cares only about dominance and subverting any possible power structure that could arise. So China, being it that they have now created $30 billion that they've signed in trade deals with Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states, increasingly that's even more, they are working to guarantee those supply lines and also make sure that that zone of instability, which has been a zone of geopolitical turmoil for many, many decades due to Anglo-American influence, becomes a zone featuring Belt and Road projects development, which they are offering to all of the Gulf states as well as the broader Southwest Asia. And that is something that I think a lot of the leaders of Southwest Asia are looking at, hopefully seeing that maybe there is a viable new game in town that involves taking their genuine, authentic self-interest into account instead of playing one against another for geopolitical purposes.
All right. Thank you so much for that. Let me introduce our next guest. Kim Do-ju joins us. He's a political commentator at the Pangol Institution. Kim Do-ju, welcome to Economic Divide. Any move by Saudi Arabia to actually move ahead and ditch the dollar in its oil trade would be very damaging for the U.S. and its economy. It is said that it's going to actually decimate the U.S. economy because of the exchange that happens there. To what degree do you think the U.S. economy would suffer if such a move was actually turned out to be a realization, which is what the Chinese president wants to, in essence, do?
Well, I think the U.S. is suffering from their own action, from their own, obviously, lack of commitment, because in a sense, the U.S. provides this public goods, you know, for the use of U.S. dollar by other countries, in particular in the deals of, buying and selling of oil internationally. We know 80% of those transactions is done through U.S. dollars. But because of the U.S., their own action of freezing the foreign reserve of other countries, that's has sent a chilling, obviously, message to many countries. If you are seen by Washington as not that loyal to Washington, or if you refuse to toe the line of Washington, and then there's a danger Washington will punish you. For example, through the use of U.S. dollar. And of course, the use of U.S. dollar or the U.S. financial system is one of the pillars for the U.S. empire. We know, along with other pillars, for example, the U.S. military or the U.S. tech prowess or the U.S. Economy, the largest one in the world. So, I mean, if there's one pillar that's being weakened, so that means the U.S. Dominant position around the world will be weakened. But it's mostly because of the United States, not because of other countries.
It's time now for the Infinews section of the program. This is where we review economic news from around the world. And this is the new year, so let's see what we have going. Some of these news, of course, could be from recently before the year to have ended. First up, the Russian President Vladimir Putin is saying no. What is he saying no to? Well, he has banned all oil sales to price cap states. That's now confirmed. The move is in response to a Western coalition price limit on Russia's seaborne oil exports. Now, under this price cap, which took effect on December the 5th, but it took a while for Russia to actually confirm it, oil traders must promise not to pay above $60 per barrel. Now, Russia's ban would halt crude sales to countries participating in the price cap, which will start from February 1, July 2023. That's another 6 or 7 months. Why would it start then? Great question. We'll have to find that out and relay it to you. Next up, looking at how every cent is being counted. Whose case is that? Well, it belongs to wealthy Americans. They are spending less. Millionaires in that country are becoming more budget conscious as a result of inflation. No surprise there. However, for the millionaires to be budget conscious, that's a surprise. 80% of these millionaire respondents who have investable assets of $1 million or more have been questioned, and they are saying that they're being cautious about the money that they're spending. Taking a look at Germany, we've focused on Germany and its economy. In this case, I don't want to say downfall, but Germany is facing a serious risk of going into bankruptcy, believe it or not. And it's due to the inability to find a solution to the current energy crisis. No surprise there. We've said that time and again, but obviously, it's reached a critical point, if it's not beyond that. infrastructure, energy prices, and the inability of the German government to actually pay for its, basically, in essence, its expenses is what's driving Germany towards bankruptcy. Okay, so obviously a big concern there for Germany. And finally, we take a look at the U.S. in terms of recession calls in that country. This was such a huge deal in terms of the prediction that was made that we decided to pick the topic again. Economists have placed 70% chance for U.S. recession for the year 2023, which we're in now. The probability of a downturn for this year has climbed from what used to be 65% odds back in November, and now it's more than double what it was 6 months ago. Now, the median estimates see the gross domestic product of the U.S. averaging, I want to make sure I'm looking at this correctly, averaging a paltry 0.3% for next year. That may sound actually very little, which it is in essence, but for a country of that size, it's not that small. However, it's something that the U.S. needs to watch out for in terms of sliding into a recession, which many say actually the U.S. is in one already. This particular topic, just so you know, is something that we're going to cover in about a couple weeks' time, so do tune in for that. Those were the topics we picked for the InfoNews section.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for the in-depth section of the program. It's called the dawn of the petro-yuan era. When the Chinese president visited Saudi Arabia, he made sure that the Saudi crown prince understood what he was there for, and he meant business, one without the use of the dollar, at least for now. Well, Xi promised to import crude oil in a consistent manner and in large quantities from the GCC countries of the Persian Gulf. Of course, that includes Saudi Arabia, and that does also include natural gas. But Xi Jinping made an offer that was difficult for Saudi Arabia to ignore. It would be guaranteed buyers of oil and gas, but China would pay in yuan. Now, the Chinese President Xi also said that China and Persian Gulf nations should make full use of the Shanghai Petroleum and the National Gas Exchange as a platform to carry out yuan settlement of oil and gas trade. Now, Beijing promised to import crude oil in a consistent manner and in large quantities from these Persian Gulf countries. The internationalization of the yuan, that was what China's goal was. And to make sure that that message was conveyed, it signed over $30 billion in deals with Saudi Arabia during this trip, which would involve payments, you guessed it, in the yuan. Next, Xi Jinping and his large Chinese delegation of officials and business leaders who met with the leaders of the Gulf Cooperation Council of the Persian Gulf to promote increased trade. Now, that means expanding the trading scope, praising increased strategic or commercial partnerships across the GCC, complete with the 5G communication, hello Huawei, new energy, and space and digital economy. These were all included, and yes, payments to be made in the yuan. China wants to push out the dollar slowly, so it's going to do trade and, of course, pay in yuan, and it will use this route to do that instead of all in one swoop with oil and gas. Now, like a slow-moving train, the BRICS Plus, the SCO, and the EAEU have all been energized and will be the conduit for trade minus the dollar. The SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, for example, has 40% of the world's population. Then comes the payment systems, which would exclude SWIFT. Both Russia and China have widened the accessibility of their systems in order to process transactions. And for the final blow to the dollar, international cards will be used, replacing the dominant Western cards like Visa, MasterCard, and American Express. This means bye-bye to the dollar sanctions, and this would be in full synchronicity with Riyadh.
The Russian foreign minister said it himself,
and he could not have been more straightforward. quote, the work has accelerated in the transition to national currencies in mutual settlements. Sound familiar? He also said the process of creating a common payment infrastructure and integrating national systems for the transmission of financial information has begun. What do you think? Do you think he said it best? Let's find out what our guests think. Let me reintroduce them. Matthew Everett, Senior Fellow at the American University of Moscow, rejoins us. Matthew Everett, welcome back. Taking a look at China's growing influence when it comes to the West Asia region, in particular Persian Gulf countries. Well, obviously, the U.S. is sitting idly by, very nervous. Add to that other countries who, in essence, are moving away from the U.S., leaving the U.S. somewhat out in the cold, especially moving away from the U.S. dollar. How worried should the U.S. be?
The U.S., as it stands, is very worried, obviously. There are geopolitical grand strategists losing a lot of sleep over the fact that the BRICS plus nations are growing. Increasingly, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Algeria, Turkey are increasingly jumping on board more and more with this new system that involves not only the BRICS plus, but also the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which has been putting online not only a new financial architecture with payments being settled in yuan as well as local currencies. India is increasingly on board, so is Pakistan, so is Iran, ever more. But you also have a security component as well, which involves a very different philosophy of thinking about the respective nation states and different national and also civilizational forces as mutual partners in common interest orientation, projects that benefit everybody in a win-win philosophy, which is very different from the Hobbesian zero-sum thinking, which has really poisoned the spirit and minds of those making policy in Western governments, and that's been going on for far too long. So there is, a lot of fear that this system is something that they cannot disrupt as easily as they used to. And the fact is the current system of the West is collapsing. And as the banking system does melt down, that gives them a lot less tools. And I'm talking now of the Anglo-American establishment, a lot less weapons are available for destabilizing governments you don't like. So on the one hand, it is something that is scary for them. But at the other hand, I think it is a bit of a wake-up call for those who need to realize that the world does not work in a zero-sum Hobbesian fashion and works very differently, which is a good thing, ultimately.
All right, let's find out what Qinzhou Zhu thinks. He's a political commentator from the Pangol Institution. Qinzhou Zhu, welcome back. Taking a look at China, its influence in the West Asia region is obviously flourishing, especially with this visit by Xi Jinping. And countries are moving away from the U.S. and the U.S. dollar, for that matter. How worried should the U.S. be about this?
Well, I think it's really, as I said, up to Washington to make some wise and long-term policy in terms of their relationship with this regional powers. For example, their relationship with the Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia, their relationship with Iran, their relationship with very important elements in this region. Now, for China, China is not seeking to dethrone the United States as a dominant power globally or regionally. For China, whatever business, China sees it through long term. That is, you have to do it in a win-win cooperational means. Because if you do business simply for your own sake and you don't consider or take into consideration of interests of the other party, and that kind of deal will not endure, will not be sustainable. So China chooses to cooperate with countries like Saudi Arabia, with Iran, with other Arab countries. If you look at the content of cooperation, it's really about infrastructure. It's about the energy cooperation. It's about the renewable energy. So in that sense, if both sides will benefit from such cooperation. And even the U.S. will benefit from, better infrastructure, for example, in Saudi Arabia and in this region. So no, China is not competing with the U.S. or not driving the U.S. Out of this region. It's really up to the U.S. U.S. is focusing on security, focusing on selling arms to these countries, profiting from selling arms, profiting from even tension in this region. That's not sustainable because this region, countries in this region and people in this region, they deserve a better life. They deserve security. They deserve development. And China is here to play that kind of a role. I think that explains why China is popular, why China is welcomed, by Arab countries and other countries in this region.
a profound shift if Saudi Arabia and China go ahead with their plans to ditch the U.S. dollar in their mutual business relations. The global standing of the U.S. dollar is partly grounded on the fact that it plays a pivotal role in global oil transactions. Even if some of Saudi Arabia's crude exports is traded in anything other than the U.S. dollar, it would significantly weaken the status of the U.S. currency. The majority of global oil sales are done in dollars, and the Saudis have traded oil exclusively in dollars since the year 1974. That was part of a deal struck between the Saudis and the Nixon administration that included security guarantees for the kingdom. Furthermore, Saudi Arabia has defied U.S. pressure to limit dealings with China and break with fellow OPEC Plus oil producer Russia. And in turn, China has stepped up its support for the kingdom, including helping Saudi Arabia's missile and nuclear programs. Saudi relations with the U.S. has been frosty in recent years, since President Joe Biden vowed to make Riyadh a pariah state during his campaign for the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. The U.S. economic relationship with the Saudis is diminishing. This could further weaken the U.S. dominance in the West Asia region.
In conclusion, the rise of China, India, Iran, ASEAN, and Eurasia and West Asia, they're here. ASEAN may actually displace the EU as the world's most powerful economic bloc. Now, India and China will utterly, which is predicted is going to happen, will crush the Anglosphere economically in the BRICS Plus formation, which will include Saudi Arabia and Iran, just to name a couple. Russia, Venezuela, China, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, as part of OPEC, will control the oil and gas. All of this would then leave the Western and U.S. grip out in the cold. Countries are just tired of the U.S. using the dollar as a weapon, which all means that the U.S. dollar would lose its supremacy. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Really enjoyed having you on board. For Mika Vitale and the team, it's goodbye until the next program.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Taxi. Taxi. My destination is Bandar Turkaman Pier. Thank you. Watching migrating birds has always been attractive to me. This season of the year is perfect for the birds migrating from the north to this island. I mean, Ashurada Island. It's one of the wonders of the nature, the way a flock of birds fly and move together. Ashurada Island is a perfect place for birds, seagulls, flamingos, pheasants, because this island is uninhabited. Iranian northern coastline is characterized with its unique, pristine nature, a combination of sea and forest. Being extended from Astara on the far west of Caspian Sea to Bandar Turkaman on its far east, it is a 660-kilometer-long coastline. Throughout the Caspian Sea southern coastline, there is only one Iranian island, Ashuradeh. Being 40 kilometers to the west of Gorgan, capital of Golestan province, the island is a part of Miankale Peninsula. The total area of the island used to be 1,200 hectares, 800 hectares of which has submerged into the Caspian Sea. Being 26 meters below sea level, it is a mild climate island, 5 kilometers west of Bandar Turkaman. During its heyday, the locals used to do animal husbandry, bakery, and fishery. But after the island was flooded in 1993, the locals migrated to Bandar Turkaman. Being registered as a natural reserve, it is a befitting natural habitat for the region wilderness. Being so, there is a wide range of animal species in the region. Its vegetation includes raspberry bushes, sour pomegranate trees, to name a few, and its wilderness consists of fox, jackal, rabbit, fish, seabirds, pheasants, and partridge. It is worth mentioning that the region accounts for 40% of Iranian caviar fishing. Under Soviet seas in the First World War, some hospitals, residences, fortresses were constructed in the island. Through the passage of time, only one fort has remained and has been registered as a national heritage. Here's the Bandar Turkaman Pier. I have to take a boat and take a tour to Ashurada Island. It's about 10 minutes. And the boatman is ready and we set off. Ashurade has a great history. It's registered internationally as one of the natural reserves in the world. It's also one of the most important wetlands in the world. A perfect natural habitat for the region's wilderness. I'm going to visit the Triangle Fortress and then I'll pay a visit to Myankale Wetland. It's interesting to note that during the safari period, this island was a hunting ground, while during the Qajari period, this island became the starting point and destination of commercial ships. Boats usually dock at the side of the wooden bridge and we have to pass over it to reach the island. At the first look, you can understand that how special this island's vegetation is. Raspberry bushes, sour pomegranate trees. Wow, unique, very special. Some historical documents indicate that palm trees, cotton, and sugarcane were also grown in this island. And here I am, near the Triangle Fortress. It used to be a military fortress in the past, with three watchtowers. The entrance of the fortress has an arched facade made of bricks. I call it oral history. It doesn't have a very special decoration since it's a military fortress. Let me walk inside. It has almost 11 chambers, very old. And it has been registered in the list of National Heritage Sites. Oh, I can also see the fortresses built during the Safavid era from this point. Great! Did you know that how pristine this island has remained? I have a great feeling here. Just listen. The sound of waves that reach the coast is really comforting. And look at those sand hills. They're so untouched. Wow, look at them. We have a lot of guests. I'm talking about the migrating birds. Thank you. And in the last part of my trip, I have come to Myankale Wetland. Myankale Wetland is actually a heaven for the migrating birds, flying from different parts of the world. Listen. Wow. The best music. The sun is about to set, and I feel happy to be here in this beautiful Iranian island.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A few strive in the cause of God, victory will definitely follow. The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary.
The judiciary should use expert opinions. Whether this is in the public force, in the Ministry of Intelligence, or elsewhere, the officers who are present sometimes have professional expert opinions. Pay attention to their opinions. Another issue is something that the officers often complain to us about. For example, they say that when they object that why hasn't a certain matter been dealt with, they're told that matter has been dealt with. They're told we gave it to the judiciary and the judiciary did not do anything. So they ask the judiciary why they haven't done anything. They are told that a law about this case doesn't exist. But if you do not have a law about this matter, who should write that law? You must write it. Make a bill. Write it, give it to the parliament to approve it for you. This should not happen that an officer struggles, makes an effort, does something, and then he comes to the judiciary and is ignored by them due to the negligence of the judiciary or a lack of expertise on the part of the judge in the particular case. In such a situation, his effort will be wasted. So this is the sixth point.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A comprehensive approach of the relationship between the judiciary and the officers is needed. The seventh point I would like to make is the issue of the psychological security of the people. This is a right of the people that I said I would talk about. The people have a right to psychological security. What does psychological security mean? It means every day a rumor, a lie, or a frightening statement should not be spread to people's mind. Only newspapers were doing such things until yesterday. Now the internet is doing this too. Once in a while, every few days, or sometimes every few hours, a rumor, a lie, or something bad is said by a specific person or an unknown person, and this is published in the internet. These statements worry people and ruin their minds. Some people tell a lie, or they spread a rumor, well, the people will no longer have psychological security in such a situation. One of the duties of the judiciary is to deal with these instances. Of course, I have heard people say that we do not have a law about this. First of all, the existing laws can be used for this, and based on these laws, the related ruling can be reached.
That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
After the defeat of Takfiri terrorists supported by the United States and its allies in Syria, Western countries are always seeking to create unrest in Damascus. One of the cases that the West hypocritically pursues during United Nations sessions is the case of the use of chemical weapons against civilians in Syria, which the Syrian authorities have consistently rejected and blamed Western-backed terrorist groups for these heinous crimes. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The website, The Cradle, has covered this story and tells us more. The United Arab Emirates ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations has deplored attempts by certain states to politicize the Syrian chemical weapons file, stating that all parties must adhere to the fundamental principles of the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW. Lana Zaki Nosseibeh made the remarks at a Security Council session on the situation of chemical weapons in Syria on Friday, 6 of January 2023, stating that the issue has turned out to be one of the most politicized files of the United Nations organ. She highlighted that all sides must respect the OPCW's basic principles, including consensus and avoiding politicization. Lana Zaki Nosseibeh said, "On 13th of January 1993, then UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali opened the Chemical Weapons Convention for signature in Paris, and 130 countries signed the treaty. This is proof of the international consensus about the accord, and the treaty is viewed as one of the most important historical achievements in the field of disarmament." She pointed out, nevertheless, the Syrian chemical weapons file is one of the Council's most politicized files. Nosseibeh highlighted, "The United Arab Emirates has repeatedly condemned the use of chemical weapons in any place and at any time, by anyone and under any circumstances. because the use of such munitions is a blatant violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention provisions and international principles. The top UAE diplomat pointed to the remarkable progress on the path of resolving the Syrian chemical weapons issue, calling on all parties involved to have a constructive dialogue. On 14th of April 2018, the United States, Britain and France carried out a string of airstrikes against Syria over a suspected chemical weapons attack on the city of Douma, located about 10 kilometers northeast of Syria's capital, Damascus. That alleged attack was reported by the White Helmets Group, which published videos showing them purportedly treating survivors. Leaked Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons documents later showed that the investigators of the Douma incident had found no evidence of a chemical weapons attack. However, the organization censored the findings under pressure from the United States and its allies to conceal evidence undermining the pretext of the US-led bombing campaign of Syria just days after the alleged attack. The Western media and Western governments have repeatedly accused the Syrian government of using chemical weapons against its own citizens. It comes as Syria surrendered its stockpile of chemical weapons back in 2014 to a joint mission led by the United States and the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, which oversaw the destruction of the weaponry. It has also consistently denied using chemical weapons. Press TV's website has also covered the same story and tells us more. Syria's Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations has called on the UN Security Council to change its approach vis-à-vis his country's chemical file and deal with the related developments objectively and preserve its technical nature by standing away from any politicization. Speaking at a recent United Nations Security Council meeting on the situation in West Asia, in New York, Al-Hakam Dandi said Syria has voluntarily acceded to the Chemical Weapons Convention, the CWC, destroyed all of its stockpiles of chemical weapons and their production facilities, and agreed to extend the tripartite agreement for 6 months. Al-Hakam al-Dandi argued that certain Western countries insist on flouting the Security Council's resources and time instead of discussing pressing issues about maintaining international peace and security and upholding the goals and principles of the Charter of the United Nations. Dandi dismissed accusations leveled by certain Western countries against Syria, saying such false claims are rooted in unprofessional and non-objective reports that come out as a result of political pressure being exerted on the Technical Secretariat of the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, and its various teams. He noted Syria also renews its demand on the OPCW to rectify its course of action and stay clear of any politicization, which has dominated its activities for many years. Dandi reiterated Syria's categorical condemnation of the use of chemical weapons by anyone and at any time and at any place and under any circumstances. The Tasnim News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has blasted the UN Security Council for holding meetings on Syria's chemical weapons file repeatedly, despite the country's full cooperation with the world body, saying that such a trend may prove the political nature of such meetings. Addressing the recent UN Security Council meeting titled "The Situation in West Asia," Amir Saeed Irabani, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations, renewed the call for any investigation into the use of chemical weapons saying that such investigation must be impartial, professional, credible and objective, and in full compliance with the Chemical Weapons Convention, the CWC. Irabani said while the Syrian Arab Republic has met the requirements of the convention and continues to cooperate constructively with the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, handling this file in a political and double standard manner will only divert discussions away from their technical nature. The Iranian diplomat stressed the politicization of the provisions of the Chemical Weapons Convention, the CWC, and the exploitation of the OPCW for political purposes threatened the credibility of the organization and the Chemical Weapons Convention, underlining that Syria voluntarily acceded to the Chemical Weapons Convention, the CWC, in 2013. Amir Said Irabani said, "We believe that the collaboration of the Syrian Arab Republic with the OPCW should be recognized." Bassam Sabah, Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations, said back in March that the United States was seeking to discredit his country and exert political pressure on Damascus by manipulating reports compiled by the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW. Reiterating his country's vehement opposition to the use of chemical weapons under any circumstances, Bassam Sabah told the UN Security Council meeting in New York that serious flaws in the OPCW fact-finding mission's report on Syria had tarnished the image of the international body. He emphasized Damascus's consistent cooperation with the OPCW aimed at closing the file once and for all, and called on all member states to deal with the issue professionally and impartially and not to jump to preconceived conclusions. Syria gave up all of its chemical weapons in 2013 and joined the Chemical Weapons Convention after a sarin attack in the southwestern town of Ghouta left dozens of individuals dead. Western countries claimed the attack was carried out by the Syrian government, but it placed the blame on foreign-backed terrorist groups. In 2014, a report of an investigation by journalist Seymour Hersh confirmed that Takfiri terrorists' possession of chemical weapons at the time.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The two-year anniversary of the election integrity protest, which burst into Congress on January 6, 2020, has been overshadowed by Congress's historic failure to select the third most important post in the country, the Speaker of the House of Representatives. After more than a dozen votes, mainstream Republican Kevin McCarthy finally won a majority, ending the total paralysis of the new Congress. However, the embarrassing stalemate was the worst of its kind since before the American Civil War.
Both of them just show how American politics is dominated by spectacle and political theater, while Americans who are suffering through a terrible economic hardship right now and are politically polarized are just sitting on the sidelines while all this plays out.
As the speaker chaos continued, Democrats demanded attention for 2020, while Republican lawmakers largely ignored the anniversary. The stark difference isn't surprising. Polls have long shown that 35% of the country still calls the events of January 6th a legitimate protest, while 50% still calls it an insurrection. The subsequent January 6th committee to investigate the incident was either branded a political show trial and witch hunt or a necessary defense of American-style democracy.
It should have been a bipartisan inquiry, a serious one, into what was, you know, supposedly this, you know, vast constitutional violation by Trump and his campaign and his administration, and it's just become this endless commercial for the Democratic Party, which is totally bankrupt. And 2 years later, they're still using it to, you know, try and get themselves elected.
While Washington is repeatedly faulted for encouraging protests in other countries, almost 200 January 6th protesters have been sentenced to prison terms. Seemingly every participant has been publicly hunted down, which may serve as a chilling effect which forestalls future protests. Has Washington's response to the controversial events of January 6, 2020 reduced conflict, division, and disunity? We cannot ask Congress, because just like 2 years ago, they cannot meet in peace. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
It's afternoon, and many Rohingya women are waiting in a queue to receive blankets offered by an NGO. Some are angry since they haven't received any blankets yet. Over the last few days, northern India has had freezing weather, and that has heaped misery of homelessness for the refugees living in makeshift tents. Zahid Hussain has come out of his shanty to have some sunlight. He says he's worried as his child has developed a skin disease that's getting worse and worse. He asked me to come to his shanty, where he is living with his family in appalling conditions.
My child is very sick. He got some skin disease. God knows what it is. But doctors say it's chickenpox or measles. He is very irritated due to uneasiness of skin. The day starts with his sickness, and all day long it's silently killing him with fevers and chills. Once a doctor from some NGO came here and gave medicine, but nothing worked.
Activists say such treatment of the community is against the Indian ethos of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which translates to the world is one family. In recent years, a vicious expulsion campaign has shed more light on the way India treats specific communities. Rights activists have been urging the government to adopt a uniform refugee policy which treats refugees equally, regardless of their faith or ethnicity. Thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are braving the cold weather and live in makeshift tents across the Indian subcontinent. These people, who always face the threat of detention and deportation, are here struggling for survival.
In this camp, children are getting sick and the sickness is unusual. They are getting chills, vomiting and fever. We have never seen this skin disease before. Even after visiting the doctor, the children are not getting any better. In every family, you will find children with this sickness. Now even women and men are getting affected. It's a very dangerous situation. Some say the sickness is spread to other camps. Doctors have advised us not to have guests from other camps and not to visit them.
Many refugees I spoke with shared heart-wrenching stories with me, and most of them kept asking why their voice is not being heard in the age of technology. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent